Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dodson. On this edition of the podcast, you hear the latest on the announcement of the closing of a Hammond hospital. Brandon Smith reports Governor Eric Holcomb vetoed a bill that he says would have tied the hands of local health officials during public emergencies. And Chris Nolte has a conversation with Jamie Palmer with the Indiana University Public Policy Institute. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. Northwest Indiana's largest city may soon be without a full-service hospital. WBEZ's Michael Puente reports.
It started out as St. Margaret Hospital more than 100 years ago in Hammond, right on the Indiana-Illinois state line. It has grown to 226 beds and serves a heavy minority population in Hammond, Calumet City, and Chicago's far south side. The hospital's not-for-profit Catholic owner, Franciscan Alliance, announced yesterday it plans to shrink it to an 8-bed acute hospital with an ER. Hammond's Mayor Tom McDermott Jr. says the owners are going against their mission.
It's a move away from minorities. It's a move away from poor people, and it's a disgrace. It's a joke.
The move comes as Franciscan is investing in new healthcare centers in more affluent communities in Northwest Indiana. The healthcare provider says it's still committed to Hammond. For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Michael Puente.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson. An East Chicago ordinance that would have limited the city's cooperation with federal immigration enforcement was struck down recently by an Indiana judge. Lake County Judge Thomas Hallett ruled the so-called welcoming ordinance violates Indiana law. The 2017 city ordinance was one of several around the country that, among other things, directed city officials and law enforcement not to share information with federal immigration authorities, like a person's immigration status, work location, or contact information. But a 2011 Indiana law specifically bans local governments from restricting communication or cooperation with federal officials when it comes to information about citizenship or immigration status. A similar Gary ordinance was also struck down last year. That ruling is being appealed.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
U.S. Representative Frank J. Mervan is seeking more than $42 million for Northwest Indiana now that members of Congress again can request specific funding for district projects and federal spending legislation. The Times reports the first-term congressman this week asked the House Appropriations Subcommittee on Energy and Water Development to help him carry on the legacy of U.S. Representative Pete Visclosky by funding several projects focused on improving the Lake Michigan shoreline. Specifically, Mervan requested $18.4 million to expand the capacity of the confined storage facility for dangerous material dredged from the Indiana Harbor, $10 million for general water infrastructure improvements in Lake and Porter counties, and $5 million for operations and maintenance at Indiana Harbor. He's also seeking $2.5 million for sand nourishment at Indiana Dunes National Park to prevent beach erosion and $1.6 million for maintenance dredging at Burns Waterway Harbor, which Mervan said is needed to ensure operations at Port of Indiana continue uninterrupted. Records show Mervan separately has requested $2 million for snow plows and firefighting equipment at the Geary Chicago International Airport, $1.2 million to support job training programs at Ivy Tech Community College in East Chicago, and $682,000 to begin work on closing a gap at the Marquette Greenway Trail in Geary from Bridge Street to the Hammond border. The Democratic-controlled U.S. House this year ended a prohibition on so-called earmarks that was enacted by the Republican majority in 2011 as a way to cut wasteful spending and reduce the influence of special interest groups. In practice, however, the earmark ban gave the White House more control over federal spending decisions and generally made it more difficult for Congress to enact appropriations legislation because members often had no items of local interest included in the measures. House Republicans are divided on the issue. However, none of the seven Hoosier Republicans serving in the House is seeking any funds for his or her district.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The Indiana Department of Revenue issued guidance Tuesday on how Hoosiers who got unemployment benefits last year should file taxes. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Justin Hicks reports it comes after weeks of the department asking people to wait due to potential legislative changes.
Indiana DOR wants to be clear. Hoosiers who received unemployment benefits cannot claim the roughly $10,000 federal tax break on their state taxes. That applies even if the unemployment benefits came from one of the new federal programs started in the pandemic. It comes after the legislature passed a law linking Indiana's tax code to pre-pandemic language. However, there may still be other tax deductions for out-of-work Hoosiers. The state recently issued an updated worksheet on their website to help people determine exactly what that might be. All Hoosiers still need to pay their taxes by May 17th this year to avoid late fees. DOR says if people with benefits have already filed, there's no need to amend their tax return at this time. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Justin Hicks.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A pair of Hoosiers received their formal charges during an arraignment hearing in federal courts Monday. Israel Tutrow of Greenfield and Joshua Wagner of Greenwood were formally charged with four counts each after their alleged roles in the January 6th insurrection at the United States Capitol. Their charges include violent entry into the Capitol and disorderly conduct. Both pled not guilty. During the arraignment hearing, prosecutors read formal charges but did not provide additional information on the government's case against the two men. Tutrow and Wagner are expected back in court in early July after prosecutors finalize the discovery process. The men are the second and third Hoosiers to face formal charges. Last month, John Schaefer became the first person in the country to plead guilty after he struck a deal with prosecutors to testify against fellow members of the Oath Keepers, a far-right group. More Hoosiers are expected to face formal charges this month.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Governor Eric Holcomb issued his third veto this year Tuesday, rejecting a bill that would have tied the hands of local health officials during public emergencies. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on why Holcomb said he vetoed the controversial measure.
The legislation would have barred local health officials from issuing emergency rules that went any further than restrictions created by the state. Instead, only local legislative bodies, county commissioners or city councils, could have done that. So, for instance, county mask mandates now in place, with the state's mandate repealed, would be blocked unless approved by those local elected leaders. Governor Holcomb says the bill undermines local responses to emergencies that have been key throughout the COVID-19 pandemic. The state's response to the virus, he says, was influenced greatly by the knowledge that local health officials could also respond to the rapidly changing situation. With the work of addressing and recovering from the pandemic still ongoing, Holcomb says he vetoed the bill to avoid disrupting that. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Governor Eric Holcomb has vetoed a law that would require gasoline with 15% ethanol to be labeled at the pump. E15 gas can harm the engine of cars as well as some motorcycles, boats, and lawnmowers. Holcomb says the Environmental Protection Agency already requires E15 to be labeled and called it an unnecessary and confusing additional layer of government. But the EPA may not require those labels for long. Under the Trump administration in January, the agency proposed modifying or removing the label on E15 gas to provide additional opportunity for E15 within the fuel's marketplace. The EPA suggests that because many people are driving newer cars than 2001, it's time to reevaluate whether the E15 label is necessary. Ethanol manufacturers say the law is the oil industry's attempt to reduce competition from biofuels at the pump. Ethanol has been touted as a more climate-friendly alternative to traditional gasoline. But ethanol mandates have not had a big impact on greenhouse gas emissions, and environmental activists say the need to grow more corn has led to the destruction of wildlife habitat.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
It's been nearly 3 weeks since a gunman killed 8 people at a FedEx warehouse in Indianapolis. The shootings still resonate for those who lost family or friends. And in a case like this, when relatives say the killer had mental health issues, the lingering impact affects many more people. Side Effects Public Media's Farah Yousry reports.
Hopefully it won't be too bad.
Rayleigh lives in a tidy brick house on the east side of Indianapolis. The backyard has 5 wind chimes that he got as gifts or on trips.
Animal Kingdom, Walt Disney World, and this one comes from my stepdaughter.
On a breezy spring day, they combine for a beautiful, relaxing tune. Inside, the living room is filled with photos from travels with his wife, the Cayman Islands, Orlando, Florida, and more.
Fortunately, I am living a good life. I do live with a severe mental illness. I was homeless for over 10 years. You see where you at?
Beautiful home.
Well, I ain't gonna say beautiful, but it's a home.
It is beautiful.
For a long time, the former U.S. Marine was using drugs and alcohol to cope with his schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. Then he decided to seek help, and it changed his life. He's now a business owner, recovery support specialist, and a mental health advocate in Indianapolis. He knows how the stigma of mental illness can be. He remembers when he worked as a dishwasher, he had an episode and asked to go home for the day. His manager agreed, but later that day, a coworker called.
She said, "Ray, they told me to call you and tell you that if you come to work in the morning, they're going to call the police and have you arrested."
That sort of reaction can flare up after a mass shooting. Just like in Indianapolis, there's often speculation that the shooter had a mental illness, and that can deepen the stigma that surrounds these illnesses in America. Nicole Siegel can feel a change in how people treat her after a highly publicized mass violence incident.
Absolutely, I feel a difference. A person like myself is basically not trusted. People will think that at any point she could snap or be a completely different person.
Siegel is 38. She lives with anxiety, depression, and post-traumatic stress disorder. She's a marketing specialist in Los Angeles who's been managing her mental illness very well. Still, she says mental illness being repeatedly associated with mass violence makes her life so much harder, down to the little things like dating and job hunting.
I've lost a lot of friendships, and I've lost a lot of people in my life that were really good to me at one point, but I knew I could not trust them and they could not trust me.
The connection between mental illness and mass violence is actually weak. An FBI study was able to establish a link to mental illness in only 25% of mass shooting cases. In fact, research suggests that social, demographic, and economic factors are the main drivers behind violence. not mental illness. Studies also show that, compared to the general public, people living with a mental illness are 2.5 times more likely to be victims of violence, not the ones perpetrating it. That distinction is not lost on Sahar, a 30-year-old Muslim American business analyst who lives in Detroit.
I like webtoons, anime, long walks, traveling, reading, catching up with friends.
She also knows 6 languages: German, Arabic, Korean, Japanese, Spanish, and English. Sahar has a type of bipolar disorder and says that right after every mass shooting, beside the sadness, her first thoughts are,
I hope he's not Muslim, because that's the part of my identity. That's the part of me that's most visible because I wear hijab. And then my second thought is, please don't let them blame this on mental illness. Then it's associated more with violence.
Sahar asked not to be identified by her full name. She's seeking a new job and doesn't want potential employers to filter her out if they Google her name and discover she has a mental illness. There are over 51 million Americans living with mental illness like Sahar, but less than half receive help. That stigma and the fear of being perceived as a potential mass shooter are among the reasons why. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Farah Yusri.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Even though there have been many, many challenges that Hoosier communities have been facing in recent years, there is a new survey that has come out recently that says that 85% of local elected officials are very optimistic about the future of their communities. It's all from a survey that has been conducted by the Indiana University Public Policy Institute, and the chief researcher in the project is Jamie Palmer, and she's joining us from the Indianapolis campus. Jamie, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Good morning.
Will you talk a little bit about what the organization that has asked for the survey does, and we can go into more detail about the findings that you all have come up with?
The Public Policy Institute staffs the Indiana Advisory Commission on Intergovernmental Relations, which is a state commission with state and local officials that was formed a very long time ago to work on intergovernmental issues, like things that say require both state and local government or different types of local governments to work on them. And we've done this survey 14 times since the late 90s. So we're kind of excited about the new result.
Well, tell us a little bit about the outcome of what you discovered from the research, finding out how local officials are dealing with their problems these days.
Well, so if you think about it from the lens of what they identified as problems, we asked them about 78 different conditions, and they identified 40 of them, a majority of them identified 40 as either a major or moderate problem. In the top 10, they were all health issues, including drug abuse and drug crime. But if you think about it from the lens of what they thought local government should work on, the top issues were quality, affordable housing, local roads and streets, the vitality of downtowns, high-speed internet, and then drug abuse was fifth, and it was tied with K-12 education and population loss. So those actually are, a bunch of those are issues that were front and center in the General Assembly. So we hope that the survey provides some support for those discussions.
Let's take a look first at about drug abuse. I guess it rated pretty high as being a major or a moderate problem in the particular communities. How many local officials that you all were surveying turned in that as their key issue?
Well, let's see. That would be, there were a little over 600 officials that answered the survey. So it'd be about 300 that identified it as a major problem.
Oh.
When we ask them about the priorities, those get spread out more because they can only choose 3 versus deciding whether anything is a problem or not. Interestingly, it's actually a little bit less strong than in 2017, which was the last survey that we did. About 70% identified it as a major problem in 2017, and it was the number one issue to work on. So some communities must feel like they're doing, they're addressing it, and perhaps the problem is getting to be a little bit less. But drug and alcohol abuse have been a big issue since I started doing the survey in the 1990s. It was mostly alcohol back then, but then it sort of transitioned to drug abuse.
Now, are you finding, and you've discovered this over the years with the surveys that you've been working with, that a lot of the issues, of course, dealing with drug abuse and the like, are because people don't have good enough jobs in many cases, and they in turn can't afford the housing, and that's where the affordable housing problem comes in?
I don't think our survey makes that particular connection. Mm-hmm. I think there are a lot of things that have combined to create the drug abuse problem that we have right now, as it's not only a low-income problem.
How about the affordable housing issue? That seemed to rank pretty high, I understand, in this survey.
It really does, and having talked to officials around the state, I think it's a big challenge. There's not a lot of stock being built right now. I mean, I'm sure you've heard people say it's a seller's market. So anything that's out there is getting, swooped up very, very quickly. I think officials think, if we want to attract more industry, we really don't have houses for folks to live in. So we're going to have to figure something out. The big challenge is that it's not the same problem everywhere. It's a little bit different problem than, say, here in Indianapolis, where we have lots of production builders versus in the rural areas where they have basically have builders that build a few houses a year. Mm-hmm. And the economics are very different because you can get economies of scale in a big market like Indianapolis or up in the northwest Indiana, whereas in a smaller rural place, the costs are just higher because you aren't building as much volume.
And I understand that different types of infrastructure also rank pretty high in the survey. In particular, a problem that the governor and his crew have been establishing a big priority, and that's internet connectivity. They've been trying to get more broadband established around the state. And how did that rate in the survey?
It was the fourth highest in terms of what locals thought they should be working on. I'm looking to see what it was in the problems. It was kind of middle of the road in terms of what they identified as problems, but it is a really, really critical issue. I know there's been a lot of debate about what we're going to call infrastructure, especially with the national discussion about bills. But it's really almost a basic infrastructure now, right? If you aren't able to have internet, it's pretty hard to function, and rural communities really aren't set up particularly well with either having it at all or having really good quality. And I think the pandemic actually has sort of put an exclamation point on that, because everybody's needed internet to function.
And how do we feel as far as the rest of the infrastructure? In this particular case, talking about local roads and streets and county highways, how do they seem to fare in the survey this year?
So local roads and streets have always been a big issue that local officials are concerned about. I think we're starting to see, about a third said their roads were improving in their community. So I think we're starting with the new gas tax money that we have available with a little bit of a hiccup for the pandemic. We're really starting to see that communities are being able to catch up in terms of their backlog of and deal with, their most damaged or poor quality roads. And so I expect it will continue to be an issue that they're concerned about, just because it's one of those bread and butter things that citizens pay attention to. But definitely we are, I think, making some progress with what the General Assembly has been working on.
Mm-hmm. Is it mainly that they'll be able to get a better idea of what to address? They've talked about it, I know, in this past session, and they probably have to plan for the future, and they're, of course, working with a new two-year state budget, so they have more money to work with than they had expected, and that might mean for some improvements, I suppose, in the future.
So I'm not sure the budget. I think we were sort of set with the gas tax for local roads and streets, but mm-hmm. certainly with broadband and water infrastructure, I think the budget's going to make a big difference.
Well, Jamie, thank you very much for spending time going through the survey for us now. And now with the results in from the local officials who participated this time around, is this something that lawmakers will have a chance to take a better look at through the rest of the year? And maybe they'll address some more of these issues in the session next year?
That's our hope. And it's a really rich data set. So we've put out a report, but there's all kinds of different ways we could cut these data. So mm-hmm. You know, there are communities who are interested in it. We certainly can think about ways that it would serve other policy discussions.
Well, that's good to hear, too. Jamie Palmer is the lead researcher for this latest survey that has come out. It's called the 2020 Indiana Advisory Commission on Intergovernmental Relations Survey, and it was conducted by the Indiana University Public Policy Institute, and Jamie works with the Policy Institute. And thank you very much for going down the data for us, and we hope that we have a chance to break out more of this, and we'll have more let it soon. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by bensound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.